And greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. It is, it's Tuesday. It's Tuesday afternoon, and we are back here in Phoenix, Arizona, where there are no tornado sirens. I don't think we even have them installed here, actually. I forgot to turn that thing on over there. That's a bummer. And maybe the one up above, too. Maybe on continuous cycle or whatever. It is getting toward the summer here in Phoenix, but real quick, a report on the trip to Dallas and all the things that happened there, including, yes, I will, since my former opponent is making so many comments about the debate from Thursday evening, I'll make a few. I've always wondered a little bit about folks who, have a whole lot to say about debates immediately thereafter in the sense of commentary or, you might say, damage control. But anyway, we'll talk a little bit about that. Lots of things happened this trip. Some of you know that I started out with a bang. Actually, I got there on Friday. I want to thank Emilio and Trish Ramos for putting up with me for nearly 10 days. I'm hoping that their dog is returning to some semblance of normalcy now, who obviously did not like having me around. I think she was starting to take a little warming to me toward the end, but it took a lot of treats and things like that. But obviously, Emilio did a lot of driving. I mean, I don't know how many. And with that size of a truck he's got, you know, I asked him what you need a 5.7 liter engine for. And he said, well, I said, what do you haul around? He says, my dog. Said, okay, that's a Texan thing. And after the debate, though, when we saw the massive line of thunderstorms that we were going to have to be driving through to get back, I was sort of glad it was a truck that size. I, you know, if it had been a little smart car or something, I wouldn't have felt very good, with the lightning and the thunder and the sheets of rain. But anyway, as soon as I got there on Friday evening, I'm sitting there at Emilio's table. There's two cameras set up, and some of the elders from this church and are sitting there. And I don't know how long we went, but probably an hour and a half, 2 hours of theological roundtable type stuff. And I haven't seen any links from Red Grace Media, but I'm sure it'll be edited and put up eventually, and we talked about all sorts of things. And then Saturday morning, I wanted to go for a run, and I did, and I got 430 meters in, and discovered that in Texas, you've got, the soil is very much made out of clay. And for some reason, that means you don't do much with asphalt, and you make your roads out of concrete. Which means you have these, you know, seams between the concrete slabs. And there's still a rip in the front of my left shoe that caught that seam. I hadn't fallen. I started running in February of 14, 1,100 kilometers I had run. It was so fast, I didn't even have time to think about rolling, doing anything. You know, you're supposed to roll, and I was when you get thrown that fast, it's just wow. And so I, thankfully, it was better than being, you know, 4K in and 4K away from the house or something. So I just go walking back, and Emilio and Trish are night owls. Okay, I won't even tell you all the stories about stuff happening at night, sacrifices, blood, burnt sacrifices on the altar and things like that, but we only saw each other for a small portion of the day because I get up early and they go to bed real late. And so, it worked out. But, so I get back and I try to clean myself up as best I can. You know, I find a washcloth and soap and alcohol and that kind of stuff. But it's still like an hour and a half later before Emilio gets up. And I'm sort of like knocking at the door. Do you have any Band-Aids? They didn't have many. We had to stop at CVS on the way to the conference that day. Once I got to the conference, I had to go in the restroom and sort of almost disrobe and putting bandages all over stuff. And Amelia had to buy me some OxyClean to because it bled through to my shirt, you know, brand new shirt I had. Oh, it was, it came out, thankfully. So that was messed up. And lo and behold, you know, I didn't let it slow me down. Still, in Dallas, I rode on the bike 160 miles, ran 16, 17 kilometers, rode 16 kilometers, rowing, you know. So, I got some good workouts in. Lo and behold, I get on the plane on the way back yesterday, and I sit down in the seat, and I put my elbows down. You know, I ripped up my elbow here. And I just about jumped out of the plane, and I said, I've felt that before, once, about 25 years ago, when I broke my arm over here. And so I went to the world's greatest chiropractor, and she tested it. And I haven't bothered with x-rays, which would be the, you know, 100%. But she used this thing that, you know, it uses vibration. And if you hit anything, it's broken. And oh, yeah, I about screamed. So I probably broke my elbow. It's hairline fracture, irrelevant. I mean, I can do all sorts of things and, you know, no problems and blah, blah, blah. But it was a good way to start. I mean, talk about beating yourself up right off the start. And I've often said, man, I wish I had that video. I wish I had a video of me going down. If I just monetize that on YouTube, just from the King James Only guys and the Mormons and the Muslims and the Roman Catholics, posting that, I probably could have paid my house off just simply from that. It would have been great. But no, I just laid there in the middle of the road. And as I laid there, stunned, the thought crossed my mind, am I going to hear somebody in one of these houses go, are you okay? Nope, nothing happened. I just laid there, sort of hoping a car didn't come along before I could shake it off enough to get up and start assessing the damage.
Hi, Ethel, is that an armadillo? Let's get it.
Yeah, especially in one of those Texas-sized trucks, let me tell you. Speaking of Texas-sized things, everybody's houses down there are three times bigger than mine. And thunderstorms seem to be really big there, too. Man, I'll tell you, thankfully I rode. I had rented a bike, and I got 3 days in. And then I looked at the weather, and I said, man, I might as well just turn the thing back in. No reason paying for it. Their lakes are full, their rivers are flowing, there had been drought going on, there ain't no drought going on now, and they got more coming this week. There's gonna be flooding. And big storms, like I said after the debate, huge, you know, lightning all over the place. I mean, just crackling everywhere. Well, Sunday morning, I get up, and right as I get up, I start hear these big old drops, and I look outside, and it's just starting to rain. Everybody in Texas has weather bug on their phone. I mean, it's just like, whoop, first thing they go to. It's what it defaults to. And so I look at my phone, and there is a big line of really nasty storms just about to plow into Frisco. And a few minutes later, I start hearing, I have not heard tornado sirens. I don't know if I've ever heard tornado sirens. I saw a tornado when I was 4 or 5 years old in Minneapolis. I remember it. I don't know if my dad remembers, but we were in the cellar. They had cellars there. They don't have cellars in Texas for some reason. They don't have cellars here either. But we are an old farmhouse, 105-year-old farmhouse, and it was one of those things where we went down. You know how the door was at an angle, you know, like those. You know, so. And I remember looking out from that cellar and seeing the funnel cloud. So I've seen them, and I don't know if we had sirens back then or not, but or if they'd even been invented by that point. Here they go off, and so we get a tornado warning in Frisco. Nothing came of that, and lots of rain. And then Lee Dodd picks me up, drives me out to Denton, and yeah, that Denton, if you know this past weekend. And so I preached at the church, spoke on God's freedom and the issue of evil, and then we went to one of the elders' house, Mac's house, for lunch. And then he was going to take me down to Countryside, where I was going to be speaking at Countryside Bible Church, Tom Pennington. And we had a great time there. I met Janet Mefford for the first time and had a good time there Sunday evening, though there were lots more storms then, too. But we're fixing to have lunch, and they turn on the Weather Channel, and there is confirmation this time from the National Weather Service of a tornado on the ground. And they drew the line that it would be following. It's like, put the crosshairs on the house. And there it is. Like, ay, ay, ay. And so they said it was a rain-wrapped one, so you can't see it. It's wrapped in rain. And so when they described it, they said what would happen is all of a sudden there'd just be a torrential downpour, and then the winds would take it all sideways, and that's when you know you're in the middle of it. And so we're sort of watching, just, you know, we're still making lunch and all, but you hear the sirens going off again, and I'm watching out the front door, and all of a sudden the world disappears. I mean, just buckets of rain, and it's all going sideways. So it's like, I think it's time. So you've got your safe place, which is basically the most inner portion of your house. And in this case, it was a hallway, and we got all the kids in there, and you get all these blankets and pillows, and we turned off the lights, and we survived. Nothing happened. It managed to go past us, but man, it must have been close, because it was exactly what they described. So I was really glad when I got up yesterday morning and could actually see the sky, and I figured might get out of here in one piece. But wow. Maytime storms in Texas. And of course, what happened is they just go straight up into Oklahoma and become tornadoes. I mean, they call it Tornado Alley for a reason. And it's...
So we can refer to this as the Texas Tornado Tour?
That would fit. Yeah, that would fit. It was something else. So the first weekend I spoke at Emilio's Church, Heritage Grace Church, on homosexuality with Emilio, and Tom Pennington did a great presentation on Romans 1. I had been to Countryside. I think you know, we were talking about Sunday night. I think 2009 was the last time I've been there. I've been there at least twice, maybe three times. I know I was there with it's been a while. Anyways, and so we had a good turnout and got to meet a lot of folks. That was Saturday. I spoke there Sunday. They meet on Sunday afternoons, which really threw my clock off to be preaching at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something. And then Monday, I spoke at a church sort of way out in the country, sort of south of Fort Worth. And once I realized it was Fort Worth, I emailed Jeff Neal. Now, Jeff Neal's co-author of The Same-Sex Controversy, and I had not seen Jeff since, I think last time I saw Jeff was when he preached my mom's funeral in January of 2010. And so it's been a long time. And so I emailed him, and lo and behold, he was able to come to the meeting that evening. And I was speaking on homosexuality, so it was really neat to speak on homosexuality and have my co-author there, and I kept making references, and we got to talk afterwards. It was really good to see Jeff after all these years, and to realize that other people are getting old just like me. that was great. And then on Wednesday evening, I met with a fellowship group at Emilio's Church, and we just walked through Romans 9. We just opened up the text and spent about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes just walking through Romans 9, because I figured that would be useful for them if they were coming to the debate. I'll talk about the debate at the end. That was on Thursday. Got to see all sorts of folks. Also on Thursday, as some of you saw on Facebook, I had taken a tour of ICR while I was there on Wednesday. And through a connection there at ICR, lo and behold, the next day, the Duggars were taking the same tour that I had taken the day before. And mention was made of the fact that I had been there. And lo and behold, Ben of Ben and Jessa was really excited, wanted to meet me, knew about my work, had seen debates, so on and so forth. So on Thursday, we arranged a lunch. I normally don't do that on a debate day, but we did. And we posted a picture of the lunch there. And then Ben and I, it's amazing, we shot this little video on the Trinity, and that was Jessa on her iPhone. That was went out on the outside. We either had to fight with the traffic sounds or with the music in the hotel, one of the two. So we decided to go with traffic being easier to handle than music. And so we did that on Thursday. And starting Friday, I was with Providence Chapel out toward, again, the Denton area. Friday night on text reliability. Saturday morning had a sort of a men's fellowship. They had some kind of a, they had a special word for the cinnamon bun type thing they had that was just obviously soaked in butter and wonderfully delicious, but probably 500 calories a bite or something. I don't know. It was good. And again, man, we were in the third floor of this church we were borrowing. So we were right underneath the roof, and the storms were just, just amazing. I haven't seen that much rain ever, probably. And then Saturday night, I spoke on the Trinity. We had lots of technical difficulties the first night. The second night, we got most of those worked out, so it was a little bit easier on the second night. And then, like I said, Sunday, spoke on the issue of God and evil. And then in the evening, off to Tom Pennington's, and they auditioned, not what's the term? Revealed, auditioned, played for the first time. What's the term I'm thinking of? Debuted. They debuted a new song by Tom and his wife. It was really good. It's on the Sovereignty of God, and they sang it twice, actually. And very, very nice tune. I'll have to see if, I forgot to ask him if it's going to be made available. I'm assuming it's being recorded by somebody at some point. So it was pretty cool. So, like I said, Janet Mefford and her family was there. And so I made a joke at the beginning. I didn't tell you about this. I started off my presentation. I had to do this because, I mean, Janet Mefford's sitting four rows behind me. So I get up to speak and I go, I know that no one else is going to understand this, but I have to do this. It's like having been told your entire life not to take the cookie from the cookie jar. Now's the opportunity. Janet, good afternoon. And she was the only one that laughed because, you know, no one else had a clue what in the world I was talking about, but had to do it. Had to say good afternoon to Janet. So lots of other folks were there, and we had a great time. I spoke on Islam, and, you know, I had to use my mini presentation, the really small one. But it still really went well, and everybody really seemed to enjoy the presentation, and were challenged by it. And again, a great church. You know what really made me feel welcome? Is I walk in the front door, and they have a small bookstore, book room type thing. And there's a window, there's a window on this side and this side at the corner, right as you walk in. And facing you as you walk in, and they've put little shelves, they can put books there to, you know, get people's interest. All four books displayed were mine. So I was like, God Who Justifies, Forgotten Trinity, Scripture Alone, Potter's Freedom, something like that. So when you walk in, the first four books in the bookstore are books you wrote. That's pretty cool. That was pretty nice. So even though I did, man, I'll tell you, everybody was making me wear Britney Spears microphones. Oh, man. I just hate those things. Not a one has ever been made that can fit my ear. I mean, my ear is always red by the time I'm done. I'm getting a headache. Oh, I hate those things. Britney Spears microphones, they have taken over, they're called Countrymen. And they, great sound. There's no question about it. You know, it's the one that comes around here and the little thing, you know. And, oh, I hate them. Just detest them. But, oh well. You do what you have to do. And as I said, got up in the morning, and the skies were clear. The flight was on time. It was good to get home. But something tells me I think they said Thursday that storm system is going to fire back up again. And I may even be keeping an eye on that because wow. So plans in the offing for something for next year with some big names that I won't mention yet. I may be doing some severe curtailing of traveling next year, but that's one thing I would do. I know Jeff definitely wants me to come back to his church, and I really want to be able to do that. So I did see Tom Buck at the debate. He had just flown in, went straight from DFW to the debate before even going home. So it was good to see him, and we want to work something out with him as well. But we'll talk about details like that. Now, I generally don't right after a debate, especially. You know, I mean, I think you only posted the link yesterday, and I'm sure you can get the audio for free from somebody. We're asking money for it, and people always whine. But people always complain. I guess we're just supposed to do everything we do. Just, you know, I don't know how it's supposed to happen, but we're just trying to get rich, I guess. But anyway, we've posted it, and it helps defray some of the costs that we have to ask for a little something for it, and that's what we did. So you can listen to it, and I'm not sure how the video is going to work out, because it ended up being videotaped by two different groups, and so hopefully, you know, there could be format issues there. I don't know. I know that Emilio's group, Red Grace Media, has really good looking. As I said, it looks really, really good. I'm not sure who was recording for Leighton Flowers, but we're supposed to exchange videos, stuff, I guess. And eventually that will be made available in video. When I wrote up the description for Rich to put in the bookstore, he wrote back after I sent it to him. I said, that's great, because it starts off by saying, "This isn't really a very good debate, but it's interesting nonetheless."
Marketing 101.
Yeah, and my response was truth in advertising. truth in advertising. When the contact had been made with Leighton Flowers, I think Emilio made it, if I recall correctly. His initial desire had been to debate. Total depravity. And one of my criticisms of Professor Flowers has been that his forte seems to be criticizing rather than providing a positive case and a meaningfully exegetical case. And especially at that point, that was a period of time we were going back and forth on mystery and all the rest of these things. And so I had said, no, I want this to be a textually based debate where both sides have to provide a positive, text-based, defensible, examinable case from the same text. This will allow people to see the difference between, you know, people who weave stories and create a theological narrative but don't really have a basis in the text, and those who do have a basis in the text. So we went back and forth, and it was finally decided that we would do Romans chapter 9, which, if I recall correctly, he suggested. You could ask Emilio. Most of this was going back and forth via text message when Emilio and Trish and I were having dinner at a hotel in California. Yeah, it was right before the TMAI thing. So that's when most of that was happening. And one evening, we just had dinner, and we're sitting there talking about other things, and every once in a while, Emilio would say, "Okay, he just said this. What about that?" And then he'd do the response, and we'd wait a few minutes, and someone would come back. It was all done by text message. Modern world, I guess. And so I don't remember all the details, and I wasn't. All I was doing was saying, "Well, how about this or that or the other thing?" And so my concern, obviously, you know, I told a number of people, I said, I'm sort of in a non-win situation here. I'm expected to win. I'm expected to outperform someone in their first debate. And it's Romans 9. So, I mean, come on. the expectations are high. And as I said, as long as he shows up, breathes, keeps breathing, and doesn't drool, he wins. But my biggest concern was if the other side refuses to really engage the subject or goes to another subject, there's not much you can do about it, especially when you go first. It's one thing if they go first and decide to change the topic of the debate. At least you have the opportunity of choosing to either adjust or not. But it's a decision you have to make. And what happened in the debate, fundamentally, was I started and debated Romans 9. And what I chose to do was I took my text and it's a plexiglass pulpit. And I've never really liked plexiglass pulpits very much. So I just sort of, for that, since I had no notes, I didn't have anything written out for the debate, I didn't have any questions written out, nothing. I just, it's Romans 9. How many, been dealing with it for decades. So I just stood out front of the pulpit and translated and commented and worked verse by verse from about Romans 8:30 all the way down through pretty much the end of chapter 9. We both had the same amount of time. We actually had 22 minutes. I thought it was only going to be 20, but the moderator, pastor of the church, decided to give us a couple of extra minutes to say hi. So I said hi in 30 seconds and then took the other minute and a half to add to my time. And we both had the same amount of time, which I found it odd that, a couple times later on in the debate, when I pointed out that Professor Flowers didn't exegete the text, it was sort of like, well, we only have so much time. And I'm like, yeah, I know. We both had the exact same amount of time. I did it. You didn't even try. So I presented the exegesis of Romans 9, followed the argument through verse by verse, point by point, which I guess some people think is cheating or easy, another issue that we might talk about. And then it was an unusual format because I made my presentation, then he did cross-examination of me. And last I had read the emails, he didn't want to have free-flow cross-examination. He wanted to have a timed question, timed response, timed rebuttal type thing. He just spent the first 2 minutes of his rebuttal making a statement, or his cross-examination making a statement, and then started asking me questions, and it was just free flow. So I don't even know what happened about that. Oh, well, that's fine with me. I'll live with it. Roll with the punches, so to speak. And then it comes time for his positive exegesis of Romans 9. And again, you can listen to it right now. You can wait for the video and watch. This was not just him being nervous or something. All of his presentations were pre-written. I saw his notebooks. He had it all printed out in individual clear plastic sleeves. Questions, statements, it was all written out beforehand. Read word for word. And basically just started preaching. I mean, like Southern Baptists preach. I mean, the same hand gestures and the standard lilting Southern Baptist preaching tone, the whole nine yards. And I don't know how far into his positive case it was before he ever even got to Romans 9. But I'd say it was at least 8 minutes, maybe 10. I don't recall. I didn't bring my notes in here. I may have made note of it at some point. But I'm just sitting here going, he's debating total depravity. This whole presentation is on total depravity. So in essence, he chose to stick with the subject he first suggested. And so now you have two different topics. Because the topic of Romans 9 is not total depravity. It may be relevant, but that's not the topic of Romans 9. And so there were two debates. The official debate topic was not even disputed. I was the only one that substantiated a position. So as far as the official debate went, that it wasn't even a contest. It was a no contest. But then if you want to talk about a debate on total depravity, it would be nice to get an opening statement, which I didn't get to do. I never got to make a positive statement of a biblical. I mean, I could only do that in very brief summary things and answers to questions and things like that afterwards. That's what happens when you have one side that decides to basically ignore the topic of the debate and redefine things. I don't know how anyone could actually believe that what Leighton Flowers was presenting was exegesis. It was not exegesis. It was, I'm going to come up with this system, and I'm going to take this over here, and I'm going to find the noble cause, and I'm going to weave together, you know, this fabric of theological assertions, and then I'm going to eventually take it to Romans 9 and say, well, now once we understand this, then this section actually refers to this part of my theory, and this section then can be understood in light of this part of my theory. And, you know, if you think that's exegesis, okay. I'm not going to blame any particular theological institution for having taught you that, but that's not exegesis. And so, you know, the evening was still useful, if for no other reason. I had lots of people come up to me afterwards going, wow, that was a stark contrast, not only in methodology, but in argumentation. And maybe someday the other side will find someone that will actually deal with Romans 9 in a meaningful fashion. I'm like, well, yeah, I was concerned about that. I was a little afraid that might happen, and it did. And you know, afterwards, like I said, there were lots of great conversations, and I think a lot of people were at least able to see how one side can, you know, it shouldn't shock any of us when you think about it. One of us can walk through John chapter 6, and we don't have to keep continuing to jump out and go over there and go, now, before we look at this next thing, we need to understand that there's this overarching narrative, see, and because there's an overarching narrative, it sounds like it's saying this, but it's really not saying this. It's actually, you know, in light of, you know, all the rest of this stuff, it's actually saying something else. And you know, we've seen this a number of times in dealing with Professor Flowers, and unfortunately, there are a lot of other folks that sort of is how it works for them as well. And they don't seem to recognize and understand that one of the most important reasons why Reformed theology continues to make the progress that it does is that there are people that just look at that and they go, wow, one side can just let the scriptures be the scriptures. Oh, it's not that we don't have an overarching narrative. We do. But we can actually just walk through the text of scripture and substantiate our points directly from there. And so, you know, I could spend a lot of time, you know, I could have brought my notes in here and gone back over some of the, you know, he brought a lump of Plato. I do need to mention this. He says he was once Calvinist. I even heard of a lady who was introduced to Calvinism by Leighton Flowers. She's still a Calvinist and thought he lost the debate, by the way. But it is his misunderstandings of Reformed theology are numerous, very numerous. He kept conflating being dead in sin with judicial hardening, says it's a distinction without a difference, etc., etc. It was frustrating on that level because so many of the objections were not overly relevant to someone who knows a position. So, and my understanding is someone sent me a link day before yesterday, 2 days ago, something like that, right after the debate, that I guess he's put a Kindle book out called The Potter's Promise. Wow, I wonder where that came from. In fact, don't I have... Yeah, here's another... Leighton, I'm sorry, but someone beat you to all this stuff. Here's Malcolm Lavender's The Potter's Freedom to Love the World, a refutation of Dr. James R. White. So, everybody, and what did Erkin Kanter do? the Potter's Hatred? Was that the graphic that he came up with sometime around the Liberty debate time period? Was you know, with a hand, the hammer smashing a pot type thing, and you know, so everybody just loves to. It's funny though; they can't really walk through Romans 9 and talk about the potter and the clay in the context of the verses without having to run off to Jeremiah and run off to this, run off to that. You know, bring that in. No, it can't be meaning that. It's all back to Wesley and whatever it means. It can't mean that type of a situation. But one thing I did want to mention that does really concern me, and I don't know how many people caught this, but in the conclusion that he offered, and he made reference to the young fellow to Austin Fisher, who wrote, you know, Young, Restless, and No Longer Reformed. He seems to really think that's a great book. And then he made reference to something called free will theism. He was promoting free will theism. Now, if you've heard some of the other people that use that phrase, you might remember the name Brian Zond, who likewise speaks much of free will theism. Brian Zond is the man that Michael Brown debated on penal substitutionary atonement, because, of course, Brian Zond rejects penal substitutionary atonement. But just think about that phrase for a moment. Free will theism. What do they mean by that? Well, they don't mean the only sensible way that that phrase could possibly be understood. Because if you're describing a theistic system, then free will should be describing God. That God has free will. That God's will is supreme. That God's will is ultimate. That God accomplishes his free will. But what's amazing is mankind is so in love with his own autonomy and his own power and his own creatureliness that you have a system where God is being described by an asserted, grossly unbiblical attribute of the creature. Because free will theism is theism defined by man's free will. Now, as I've said many times, I believe Professor Flower's position to be man-centered. He found a rhetorical way to, and again, it'd only be relevant to people who aren't really thinking very deeply. Yes, my system is man-centered. It's focused upon the man, Jesus, and what he would have done. Exact same argumentation as Zond used in the debate with the Calvinists. Remember, we went through that rather thoroughly. And, of course, it's a misrepresentation of the Jesus of the Gospels, but it is this mechanism of being able to say that, well, the Jesus of the Bible, you know, these Calvinists, they're nothing like the Jesus of the Bible. They, of course, Zond doesn't, and Flowers do not even pretend to attempt to demonstrate that the Jesus of the Bible didn't teach these things and didn't believe in the absolute sovereignty of God or all the rest of that kind of stuff, because it's too easy to demonstrate that he did. But anyway, the reality is that this is a very, I mean, free will theism. I just don't know how someone can hold that viewpoint and that perspective and stay there, because there's just no solid ground left in theology to keep you from slipping right off into, well, where Austin Fisher is headed and Brian Zond is headed and where all the emergent movements and everything else. Once you start defining your God in light of human attributes, and I find it extremely troubling and very dangerous. And yet that's what Professor Flowers was promoting in the closing statement. Was he used the phrase free will theism. And I'm not sure how many people even understood that, but I think if they start looking around and see who else is using that terminology, they might go, that's interesting. Who knows? Who knows? But if you want your God to be defined by his creatures, there's a system for you. Of course, I think creatures need to be defined by their God, but that's just one of those differences that we have between us. If you were there, I should have mentioned this beforehand. Let's go ahead and open up the phones. We've only got 20 minutes left of the program, but 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341, just in case there was someone who wanted to make a comment about something along those lines. I did have a... I suppose I should mention one other thing. At the end of the debate, Professor Flowers did something unusual, and I objected to it. He said, you know, we really support what you do and going off into mosques and things like that. That's great. As long as you'll promise not to use it to promote Calvinism, I'd like to suggest that we take up an offering to support your ministry. I didn't tell you about that, did I? And I'm like, that would be inappropriate. It would be completely inappropriate to take up an offering for one side of a debate, along with strictures saying what you can use it for. The reality is that I am Reformed in everything that I do. When I stand in a mosque, I answer questions about soteriology from a biblical perspective, which means I'm going to present penal substitutionary atonement. I'm going to present the sovereignty of God and salvation. I'm going to present the particular atoning work of Jesus Christ. I'm not going to present the atonement as something that makes men savable, but that actually saves. So I can't accept any type of stricture that's going to say, well, you can only use these funds to promote a message other than what you believe. And that immediately is just like, what are you thinking? I mean, you might have the greatest intentions in the world, but what are you thinking? I mean, that's like, well, anyway. You know, it'd be like if he was debating a Jehovah's Witness, and the Jehovah's Witness said, you know, I love what you do on campuses, so let's take up a love offering, and as long as you don't promote the Trinity with this money, then that'd be great. What? How does that work? I don't even begin to understand how that works. So I said no, I object to that, and I would. There's just that's totally inappropriate in the context of a debate. So. There are some of my thoughts on what happened on Thursday evening. Like I said, there were, you know, Jeff and his wife and his son came, and there were all sorts of folks that came to the debate. And I posted a picture. Ben and Jessa were there till 11 o'clock at night when we left, and that's when I said, you need to get Mama home so she can get some sleep. I was a little concerned about them. I was a little concerned about them actually driving in the rain because I didn't know if they were in a nice big old hunkin' Texas truck like I was. anyways, it was good to talk to them. All right, let's take some of our phone call. Where'd my thing go? Oh, don't do this to me. I'll just have to use this over here. All right, let's talk to Dave before he gets blown away by a tornado. Dave in Denton, Texas. How's the is the lake still rising?
Well, we just got a little more rain today, and they're talking about more nasty weather tomorrow. We'll see what happens. But if we could dig a basement, we would, because I could use one right now.
Yeah. No two ways about it. I'm gonna tell you. That was an experience. Anyways, what I'm gonna do for you?
I mean, of course, you know, I was there that night, and I think you're read on. The whole thing was right on. Me and about 20% of the Reform Pub were in there watching the debate. We really enjoyed it. I will say I liked the general format. I liked that there was a lot more interaction between you guys. I thought that was very helpful. It would have been really helpful if you'd both been doing the same debate.
Yep.
Definitely. But I think that I have to give credit where it's due. The fact that he actually was willing to show up and do a debate, unlike other people who were within spitting distance of the debate that night and have been willing to talk about Calvinism, but not so willing to discuss the matter. At least he was willing to do that. So
did, as you remember, I did start off the debate saying that I need to be consistent in my exegesis of Romans 9, whether I'm in a mosque, whether I'm amongst atheists, in a Catholic church, or at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I stopped and said, of course, I'm only welcome in 3 out of those 4 places.
Yeah, exactly. I think that if nothing else, it was a very clear display of what it means to be able to handle the text rightly. And it was pretty clear he just wasn't able to do that on this subject. So I hope that for the people that were there, they just made it abundantly clear, not simply that Calvinism's right, but the fact that you have to be able to take the Bible and let it be a real ruler for everything else that goes underneath it.
But I was
definitely glad I could make it out to the seminar, the conference on the weekend before, because I was really blessed by that, and I really got a lot out of everybody's talks, yours and Tom Pennington and Emilio's. Everybody was just really on their game that weekend, so thank you very much for coming out. It was great to get to meet you this weekend.
Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate that. Yeah, the conference did go well, and obviously it was timely in light of the Supreme Court stuff and what we're going to be up against probably in just a matter of weeks. So appreciate getting to meet you and having you there.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll get you out here, and hopefully we'll not get sucked away to Oz.
Let's try the fall next time. Maybe June or something. That's going to be hot, but at least you're not going to have that kind of stuff going on. So
if you come in, just stay away from Houston. You'll be fine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Believe me, I've been in Houston in August, and it's just like, wah. Yeah.
So if it's not 100 degrees, you have a hurricane coming, so we'll just stay out of there.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, have a good one.
Bye-bye. All right. Let's continue on and talk with Ben. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Dr. White. How you doing?
Doing good.
Good. I've just got a question about the free offer of the gospel. And I listened to your sermon on the dangers of hyper-Calvinism, and I heard your dividing line. I think it was the previous dividing line before that sermon.
And in regards to David Allen, yeah.
Yes, that's correct. And I guess I'm from Owensboro, Kentucky. One of my pastors is Dr. Sam Waldron. I actually go to CBTS right now. So I'm fully Reformed, the Reformed Baptist. I just had a question about the free offer. Do you see a distinction between the desire of God? Do you see a desire, a distinction between the free offer of the gospel and a desire going forth from God, or a command coming from God? Do people make that distinction at all?
I'm not sure what you mean by desire and command. Not sure what the relationship between them is. I mean, I know what you're asking, and yeah, there's I think an appropriate discussion that needs to be had in regards to whether one has to attribute to God desires that he must leave unfulfilled, and whether he desires his own unhappiness. I think there's a very important question to be addressed as to which is more definitional of the nature of God. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, there seems to be a debate going on right now that, I'll be honest, I haven't weighed in on it because I don't have time to read the flood of stuff coming out on impassibility amongst Reformed Baptists. And to be honest with you, right now it seems like it's the two sides are so massively close to one another that, man, if there's a division or something over this, I just want to go, come on, let's divide over something important like the color of the pews or something. I mean, that's what Baptists are really good at. I hope that that's not going to happen, but sometimes that happens. You get two sides going, and no matter how close they are, they just dig a huge chasm in between them, and then it looks like it's the Grand Canyon. But, in that debate, the question is, what is foundational to the rest of our theology of God? And uh-huh. I think that when we're talking about divine decrees and God's nature and the call of the gospel, as far as I can see in the Bible, God is seeking to demonstrate his power, to make his wrath known, and to glorify his name in the salvation of a particular people in Christ Jesus. Uh-huh. That seems to be, when you ask the big question, the why question, Ephesians 1:6 says it's all going to be to the praise of his glorious grace. Uh-huh. And so I really struggle, especially coming from a background of having dealt for years with people who define God in light of mankind, specifically not Arminians, Mormons. Uh-huh. I mean, the Mormon scriptures say man was in the beginning with God, and that God's glory is to bring about the eternal life of man. And of course, God is an exalted man, and the whole concept there. And so for decades, I've been trying to introduce folks to a God who is self-sufficient, who did not need to create. He was under no compulsion to create. And so the idea of attributing to God, and see, I very clearly talk about the prescriptive will of God and the uh-huh. and the decrees of God and the prescriptive will of God. You have called all men everywhere to repent. It's all there. It's all clear. This represents God's holy nature. But that's not the whole story. And it seems to me that some people are saying that unless you can affirm and assert some kind of a almost human emotion to God, this is where it sort of runs into the impassibility stuff, to be honest with you. I'm not really sure how that's all playing out or if anyone's even pointed this out. But if you don't affirm some kind of a unfulfilled desire to God, where he has decreed that he's going to do one thing, but he wishes he could do something else, mm-hmm. then somehow you don't believe in the free offer. And of course, when I even hear the word offer, the only way I can understand that is if in the context of the call of the gospel, not the call of Romans 8, because that's the effective call, but the general call. So it's defined within the context of humanity, not the will of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit and the accomplishment of the gospel itself. And so I just struggle with some of the things that some people have said that you must believe, and if you don't believe that, then you don't really believe in this. And I'm just sort of like, wow, I see some major confusion there. And I just honestly, when I look at some of the folks that are saying it, I ask myself the honest question, has this person ever sought to take Reformed theology as Reformed theology into a Roman Catholic church, into a mosque, to atheists, to Mormons, to Jehovah's Witnesses? Because I'm not saying that everybody needs to do that. What I am saying is when you do that, all of a sudden there's angles and light and things that you wouldn't otherwise necessarily ever have to think about. And yeah. I have to think about the consistency. That's a big thing with me, the consistency of what I'm saying to others. And so, anyway.
I guess practically then, when you've had so much experience witnessing to all sorts of groups, can you say, or have you said, can you say that God is desiring you to repent, or God is calling you, or God's hands are out beckoning you to come to him, or is it more God is commanding you to repent, Acts 17?
Well,
you see what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do, and that's where I do step back and I go, look, if what I'm being asked to do is to follow biblical commands, mm-hmm. when Paul stood in front of non-Christians on Mars Hill, he said God commands men everywhere to repent. Now, that don't think that that meant that he was passionless. I don't think that that mm-hmm. meant that he did not have a desire to see everyone in his audience saved, but Paul also knew that that wasn't going to happen. And mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, I have to keep coming back to the fact that God has not revealed to us who the elect are. And so in light of that, our commandment is to follow what he has prescribed in his word. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned when people say, well, you need to try to make God nicer than what he has commanded us to say. You know, it's sort of like when I've presented Jesus to Muslims in debate, I recognize they're up to their eyeballs with the long-haired hippie Jesus carrying the little lamb in his arms, okay? They really are. I mean, they don't respect him. I present the Jesus of the Book of Revelation that rules the nations with the rod of iron and people hide from the wrath of the Lamb. I want them to know that Jesus Christ has authority over all men. He is Lord, and someday he will judge every single person. And once they know they're talking about truly God incarnate, then when you present his love, it's no longer sticky sentimentality. It is true uh-huh. condescension of the one true and living God. But uh-huh. if you don't have a balanced perspective there, it ends up being just sentimentality. And I think it really robs it of its power. So I desire to see every person that I'm witnessing to saved. But mm-hmm. even the Arminian has to recognize, unless they're an open theist, that God already knows. When God created, at least he learned then and has perfect knowledge of who's mm-hmm. going to be saved. And so how does that impact God? They never seem to ask that question because they're so anthropomorphizing God at that point that I don't even think they've even thought through what that ends up meaning for his knowledge and everything else. But anyways, that's just a brief response to some of that. I just need to be consistent, and I need to try to rein in my emotions. The tendency of me as a human being is to attribute to God the frustration that I have when I see people cutting themselves off from life.
Yeah.
But my God is, I've never, ever, ever seen a biblical teaching that I am supposed to consider God and to feel bad for his frustration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that really what the prophets were talking about? Was when God does plead with Israel, is that really meant to be understood that that's to be understood in a human context? Again, that takes us back to the impassibility issue and to that big debate going on there. How is that to be understood? And I just think that we should resist any temptation to diminish the sovereignty of God while believing everything else that the scriptures say concerning his great condescension, but it all has to be taken together. And I went long on that, but I hopefully that's I'm not gonna get to solve all of those tensions there, because we are given a very full view of our God. And you know, it's sort of like looking at the story of Abraham and Isaac. Every time I look at it, I see something more, and it causes you to grow, and there's just so many things there that it could be taken badly either direction. You have to allow it to be fully balanced, and I think that's what we got to do with this, too.
Yeah. Well, okay? Thank you, Dr. Wyatt. I hope you can come up here and teach a class sometime soon.
Yeah, it's been 2010 or 11, 2010, 2011, 2011 since I was there last, so... But it was snowing
well,
then, so.
Oh, yeah. Was it?
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, I was going to look at something from Catholic Answers, but we'll have to just keep that queued up for the next time. Thank you for listening to The Dividing Line today. Lord willing, we'll be back on Thursday. And don't forget, I am doing a debate in Southern California on the 24th. Looking forward to it with an imam. We'll try to get the specific details up as soon as possible on that, unless somebody already did that. There is a banner up. Well, it would help if I looked at all the banner ads. Thank you, Micah. And the information is obviously all there on the website. I'm going to go look at it right now. See you next time.